Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
You're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Lady.
Hey, Lady.
When not on the air, my job is to eat and drink and connect people. I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear here, and working with my clients, which include chefs, sommeliers, big brand startups, those doing what's most innovative and delicious. That's Alan Phillips. He's coming on later, and he's doing some sound effects today for us.
Yes.
First off, today at the Green Market, just this morning, we'll hang out with chef to definitely watch. That's J.J. Johnson of the Cecil and Minton's in Harlem, New York City. And then in a few minutes, live in the studio, we'll have on Alan Phillips, who's just left his post as chief marketing officer of Morgan's Hotels. And before that, he worked with Myriad Restaurant Group, you know, Nobu, Tribeca Grill, and Strategic, which were the creators of Tao and Lavo and all of our most favorite nightclub spots. And he's got a book coming out next year called The Rules of Magic.
And he's awesome.
He's really awesome.
Handsome. You can't even see how handsome he is.
Well, you can see on Periscope right now. You can see on Periscope right now how handsome he is. We're on live on Periscope at Lady Sue. We'll get to brainstorming on some timely topics like how do hospitality brands appeal to dun-dun-dun millennials?
I love millennials.
I love millennials. Perhaps most importantly, we're going to find out how do you and I manifest our magic.
Yes.
Because I believe in magic.
Poof.
You will want to stay to the end because to wind it down, we'll get with sommelier Kyle Riddington of Peora in time for season 3 of the online content series Champagne Made Me Do It, a new way to talk about everyone's favorite celebration bevy.
That's my favorite excuse.
Absolutamente. Let's go to the Green Market. I'm at the Union Square Green Market with J.J. Johnson. He's the chef de cuisine at Minton's and the Cecil in Harlem, New York. Hey, J.J.
What's going on?
How are you?
Super sunny outside.
We've all been waiting for this.
I know. It's going to go by really quick, and I'm a little nervous about it.
So why do you call yourself the chef de cuisine? Because you are, like, actually the executive chef.
I mean, it's just one of those points where, you know, I want people to know that I'm still in the kitchen. I want them to know I'm still expediting work on my sous, creating, working the line. And, you know, Alexander Smalls, you know, we sit down, he works with me. So we're kind of like a team.
Okay. And also, you've got really exciting stuff coming up this summer. Everybody.
Huge summer coming up.
Watch out for, you're going to see JJ everywhere.
Maybe, yes, everywhere.
Yes. Congrats on the Eater Young Guns and the Forbes 30 Under 30 and the James Beard Rising Star nomination.
It's been a great, I used to say a great run, but now it's like super consistent.
Mm-hmm.
So my goal is just to keep it going, and hopefully I'll be on one of those covers of a magazine one day.
Well, you've got the face for it. So thanks so much for today. We're only doing radio. Thanks so much for taking a minute to join us. What's catching your eye?
I think it's like amazing that spring vegetables are still going strong. So you still see spring garlic, snap peas, asparagus. That's all amazing and in season. And then it's like mind blowing that strawberries are popping. Like they're everywhere, every stand from New Jersey to upstate New York. And now I don't even want to buy strawberries from California because these are like super ripe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the golden hairs are coming out. They're all different sizes. They're not all being picked the same size. And I think that's a great thing, you know. It's like getting an heirloom tomato.
Oh, yeah. Every strawberry is unique and special.
Yes.
And by the golden hairs, we're talking about the seeds. And we're learning from JJ that when you
see a carton of strawberries and you see that the seeds are golden colored, that's when you know they really
are ripe. Super ripe. You know, when you get them from California, they pick them early.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't get to get those golden speckles or hairs. And you get a little bit of whiteness inside and you think the strawberry is ripe because it was juicy, but really the sugars are coming out. Where these strawberries here today is like they're firm, they're plump, they're super golden, and they're just amazing. Like if you're not at Union Square Market getting strawberries today, tomorrow, next Wednesday, you're in trouble.
So how are you cooking them up at the restaurants?
I'm doing a strawberry. I'm doing like the strawberry relish with bird eye chili and ginger.
Mm-hmm.
Going with some black bass for a special this weekend. So we'll just like shave them super fine, cook down some black garlic, ginger, bird eye chili, a little bit of sake and rice wine vinegar. Mix that with some fresh Chinese parsley. And that'd be like our little relish. I won't cook the strawberries down, but I'll let the vinegar break down the strawberries because you already have the sugar in there.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing the green strawberry chow chow at Minton's, and normally you would do green tomatoes, but I was using the green strawberries, so the ones that you were kind of throwing away that people don't like. So these underripe strawberries that were like fresh and crisp and robust. And I was having Rich Produce, you know, bag them up for me and send them.
Yeah.
I thought was really awesome.
So now Rich Produce and Baldur are letting their other chef clients know that JJ
was using green strawberries,
giving the green strawberries some love.
Which I thought was cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then we do this marinated peach salad, like early peaches. And then I take green strawberries with like toasted cumin, bird eye chili, coriander seeds, and make like this nice green strawberry puree with a lot of aromatics, pink peppercorns. So you get that with like some manzina, these grilled peaches that are marinated in fish sauce and palm sugar. So it's like it's all about the strawberries this year for some reason. Not by choice, but by demand.
Right. Well, by supply.
Mm-hmm.
And so you play with the seasons. Well, this year, the spring vegetables are extra robust because we had such a wet winter, right?
Yeah, wet winter. And then the wet winter with the snow really helped us with the spring vegetables, where the spring before, it was just really bad. We had no artichokes. Asparagus was stringy. Snap peas weren't really good. So if you really paid attention, a lot of chefs were trying to cook in the spring, but they were really waiting for the summer.
Right, okay. And why is it that the spring and the rain and snow helps out the spring bounty?
It's just something about the crop. I don't know. I was at Chef Garden, and they were just telling me, like, you're going to see squash blossoms early this year.
Yep.
You're going to see tomatoes early this year. Just because of that water supply of the melted snow,
mm-hmm.
really was helping the crops.
Interesting.
You know, the interesting fact about strawberries is that it's a major component used in compost.
Why
you know,
is that?
I'm not sure. You know, they're really pushing us chefs to go composting in New York City. I would love to do it.
Yeah, the city's pushing.
The city's pushing chefs to go into doing compost, which I would love to do it. But I just don't know who's going to pick it up for us and where is it going to go.
Right. So someone didn't think through the operations of it.
I'm unsure. Maybe they did. Maybe they have something going on. Maybe they have a plant. Maybe they have a lot of farmers that are interesting that they're going to team up with, but we'll see.
Well, what I found interesting is you mentioned that it actually costs money for your bags of garbage to be picked up.
Right, so yeah, like my garbage company picks up our garbage and then they use it for an energy plant.
Right.
And they make like this double money made.
Right, what the heck?
So, it's, you know, everybody has to make money.
Yeah.
They're a reliable garbage company, though, but
So sometimes your garbage companies, like, forget to come or something?
No, my garbage company's good.
Good, okay, but
some others forget to come or, you know, whatever it might be, so I'm really lucky.
Yeah.
But I'm looking forward to the composting, and I see they're starting schools, like public schools are doing the composting,
mm-hmm.
so I wonder how they're going to integrate that into the restaurants.
Yeah, each bag of garbage, how much is that?
Mine is $3.50.
Oh, wow. Money
21
in,
bags a day.
Money out.
Yeah.
It's tough life being a chef restaurateur.
It's a tough life. You know, you have to think about everything, calculate everything.
Okay, well, looking forward to having some strawberries up in Harlem. Thank you so much, Chef JJ.
Thank you.
Ladies.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leyte Su on Heritage Radio Network. If you love what you hear, do connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I'm at Leyte Su, that's LeitiHSU, at Heritage _ Radio, hashtag WOMSHOW, WOMSHOW, that's short for Word of Mouth Show. And with that, I'm so pleased to welcome people we like.
Oh, I'm excited that you like me.
That was just for you.
You did that?
Yeah.
Wow.
No, not really. But do you like it?
Yeah, it's good. Okay. It's good. It's interesting. Okay,
yeah. So have you ever been inside of the studio?
This studio? No. But it is funny. I actually recorded something about like interesting New Yorkers at Roberta's. The last time I was at Roberta's.
But like
it was like a video thing in there. It was like eight interesting New Yorkers.
I feel like the time has come for you, the millennial whisperer, to land in the midst of this really strange.
It's wonderful.
Log cabin looking kind of shipping container of a radio station. Yeah.
I think it's wonderful. I think it's amazing. I could see all these people enjoying this amazing food from Roberta's. These pizzas look delicious.
Yes, we're like,
if you don't hear me answer your question, it's because I'm out there eating pizza.
So you know, who is the goldfish here? Like, are we the goldfish or are they the goldfish? You know,
I don't know.
You know,
I never really thought about that.
It's a little scary.
I think we might be the goldfish,
right,
in this particular case,
because we're in a smaller,
or the pizza is the goldfish.
Okay,
because the pizza looks really good.
So right now you are having a life transition. You've just a couple weeks ago left Morgan's Hotels.
I left my position at Morgan's Hotels about a little less than 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations on moves.
I'm very excited about it. I was the vice president of food and beverage there for 2 amazing years, and then spent another 2 amazing years as the chief marketing officer of the company. It was a company that I always, you know, admired and loved. I do continue to admire and love the company. It's a amazing hospitality game changer,
and made more amazing by some really fun and wacky partnerships that you birthed.
Yes, I mean, we had an amazing run there. Yep. Me and my team, and a lot of great friends and great experiences.
So tell me more about the Vice collaboration, for instance.
Well, the Vice collaboration came out of the fact that when I took over as chief marketing officer, I wanted to set up some partnerships with some really amazing and exciting brands. You know, Morgan's was founded in 1985, and it changed the game of hospitality by bringing, you know, boutique hotels into the world and birthing a lot of these exciting trends. Mm-hmm. And Vice is sort of doing the same thing in the media space right now.
So really, in that moment, you know, I don't know the whole history of how hotels have evolved, but Morgan's was like the first.
So Ian Schrager and Steve Rubell, who were the founders of Studio 54, they got out of prison, actually. They had went to prison for tax evasion.
Oh, cool.
And they were looking how to get back into the hospitality business. And they ended up, you know, they opened another club called Palladium. And after they opened, which was a, you know, mega successful club, Palladium, you know, there was artworks in that club by Jean-Michel Basquiat, Keith Haring.
Wow.
Really, really amazing place. It's in Union Square and now is a NYU dorm called Palladium. but they decided to get into the hotel business. And they bought a hotel, which is now the Morgan's Hotel, on 38th and Lexington. Mm-hmm. And that hotel was, you know, they wanted to create a hotel product that they thought represented what their friends would want at that time in 1984. So they partnered up with an amazing designer, Andre Putnam, who designed the, I believe, the Concorde. And she was, you know, very well recognized. And they proceeded to build a hotel that was really catering to the needs and wants of their generation, their friends. And they revolutionized the hotel business by creating a lifestyle hotel, a boutique hotel. And where the term boutique hotel comes from is from, you know, Steve was doing an interview about the hotel, and he was trying to explain what made the hotel different. And he said, well, you know, if a regular hotel, a Marriott or a Holiday Inn is like, you know, a department store, then our hotel is like a boutique on Madison Avenue. Mm-hmm. And that's where the term boutique hotel comes from.
Wow.
And it was, you know, an amazing success.
How long were they in prison for?
I think they were in prison for a year. I can't be quoted on that. Okay. I don't know exactly.
This is interesting. You think about how much time you have to sit around and, you know, dream up the next big thing.
Yeah, I think that the biggest breakthroughs for individuals come when they have to face the biggest hardships in their life. So you have to look at like the worst possible thing and imagine all the fears and confront your biggest fears. And if you confront your biggest fears, then
everything else is possible.
And you move forward past it.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, everything starts to happen for you.
I agree with you, and I love that. Yes. So, but before we go on to talking about magic, you did a series of dinner parties with Vice, with our favorite chefs like Seamus Mullen, right?
Like Carlo from Roberta's.
We did one with the folks.
The guys from State Bird, mm-hmm. Nicole and Stuart.
Love them.
We did one with Andy Ricker from Pock Pock.
So many people do these pop-up dinners, and there's food events galore these days, which is, I mean, definitely what we're excited about. We're excited about different ways of dining and getting people together. But what makes a food event extra good, extra special?
What makes a food event extra good?
You know?
I think it has to do with the honesty and authenticity of the people mm-hmm. involved and how it's birthed, the seed-level thought behind it. The idea behind this Vice partnership was that Vice had created Munchies, which was this amazing, you know, in my opinion, the most relevant of the, you know, food channels that are out there nowadays. And, you know, they what they do is they tell the stories in a really honest and upfront way of, you know, who these chefs are, where they came from. They do the Chef's Night Out series where, you know, they're out and about and showing the chefs in their own habitat in a way, how they socialize, who their friends are, these type of things. And, you know, the hotel space had always had, you know, it went from not caring about hotel restaurants at all to getting these vibe dining restaurants. Then from vibe dining restaurants like Asia de Cuba, they moved into celebrity chefs. Like every single hotel has to have a celebrity chef, right? And I wanted to bring...
Vibe dining.
Vibe dining. That's like Tao.
Okay. Interesting industry. Okay, I got it. I understand what vibe dining is.
Okay.
Okay, go on.
So for all the listeners out there, vibe dining is when you go out to a restaurant that's sort of like a club and you get like the best of both worlds, depending on what you think the best of both worlds actually is.
I understand. Okay.
I look at myself as someone who's trying to push the envelope, and usually where I'm working, where I'm sitting, the clients I'm working with, whatever it is, I'm always trying to come up with what's that next thing. And so with Vice, the partnership was all about, you know, bringing their food programming to life. Mm-hmm. So what would it be like, you know, everyone watches Anthony Bourdain, right? Everyone watches all this, like, you know, this food porn TV, and they always want to be a part of it. But you can't really be a part of it. Yeah, you could go on a trip, you could try that food, mm-hmm. but it doesn't have that same like theater and drama. So I was thinking, what could differentiate our hotels in that position? And Vice was able to bring, you know, the chefs to the table and, you know, millions of millennials. And we created these one-of-a-kind experiences where you were really able to eat the food of the chef in an environment in which the chef could do whatever they want, however they want to do it. And you're sort of along for the ride, and there's no real commercial, you know, thing sitting there taking some of the innocence out of it, taking some of the authenticity.
When I do events, I refuse to look at those like set menus where it's like $35 per head or $85 per head. It's always more fun to be like, hey chef, what do you want to cook that you never get to cook? Like that's always my starting point, and then that's what leads to like, you know, how the event is, you know, named or headlined.
Yeah.
I agree. I start from that.
You know, there's this. I was watching Shane Smith, who's the founder of Vice, mm-hmm. on Charlie Rose, and he said that cartoons were made to sell cereal.
Yeah.
So the current generation of, you know, let's call them 35 and under millennials, they were all brought up watching cartoons, and it created these amazing bullshit meters I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say bullshit.
Oh yeah, you're yeah.
You bullshit.
We're yeah. We can read. We can smell. I'm a millennial. We can smell bullshit from a mile away.
Yes.
Million. Yes.
So they know what bullshit is. So if you try to create some silly wine dinner or some, you know, democratic corporatized version of what you think it means to experience amazing food and drink and people, then they will know. And they're not gonna go after it. And if you look at, you know, we're sitting in Roberta's right now. I mean, this place is like pieced together. I think I'm looking at by a chef and some friends who came out here and did something honest and took a chance. And look, everyone here is reacting to it. I've never seen a dining room so full at lunch in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah,
you know,
Bushwick
amazing.
Is like quickly not becoming the middle of nowhere, but you know, for the last 5 years, that Heritage Radio has been in existence. I mean, so much has changed.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of bullshit, you know,
I'm just waiting for what's coming next.
Speaking of bullshit, I'm always curious. Like, is cool scalable?
I don't know if cool is scalable.
You know what I mean? It's painful.
This is like the eternal question.
Really?
I think for business people, for entrepreneurs.
Who want to do cool but also make it big.
Yeah, or who want to do things that are really meaningful. Like, it's very, very difficult to take something that's really meaningful and really honest and make it really, really big. Because inherently some of that is lost. Yeah. And, you know, in my future... as I evolve in my career, I have some interesting things coming down the pipeline.
Like very quickly.
those things, like my thought process is that culture needs to grow faster than the business. So the idea of whatever it is you're trying to do needs to grow at a rate that's faster than you grow the economic engine behind it. And so if you're able to grow the culture, so this thing like, you know, people watch like about Google or, you know, whatever, some huge tech companies, and they talk about like, oh, this idea is so exciting and da 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 da. If that's growing and people are more excited about that, that can then cool can be scalable.
Yeah.
Well, in my opinion.
Because cool is inherently like something that you... It's not like exclusive per se, but it's something that you want, you strive for. And so by storytelling, you can kind of, you know, be like the Sweet Life, the Sweet Green, do a concert before you have, you know, salad shops across the country and just get people excited.
That's exactly an amazing example.
Right?
They're perfect. So they're growing the culture faster than the stores.
Mm-hmm.
Although the stores are growing very fast,
this
idea, people know about Sweet Life. It's like, I think... There might be more people who know about Sweet Life than actually know about what Sweet Green is.
Yeah. And then when they make the connection, they're like, that is so cool that they did like this awesome music festival before they ever landed in Dallas.
Exactly. And then on the other side, it could be scalable. Like if you look at a In-N-Out, In-N-Out is regional. So they've controlled their growth in a very manageable way, and I would say they're as cool as they've ever been, but they kept it to a certain locale so they could manage the stores. Because once you end up, and I've tried this before, and don't try it at home, if you try to manage businesses in, you know, in Middle East, Europe, the United States, all under this same umbrella, It's nearly impossible. And an old friend of ours, or both of ours, Michael Bonides.
Yes, who was June Neoperin's business partner in Myriad Restaurant Group, which not a lot of people know.
Yeah. Michael Bonides is like Yoda of the food and beverage business. He's like the guy behind all the guys.
He has the dream job. He basically goes around the world and tells hotels how to be cooler.
He tells everybody how to make their business.
Yeah, how to be just more like delightful to their customers.
He's amazing. He's a consultant available.
And I want to mention that we met actually through hotel storytelling because you know how Michael and I met.
No.
We were both in this like I Love New York this series about interesting people in New York across all industries. that the Mandarin Oriental put together. And so they did a little shindig for us to all hang out and meet each other. And then somebody, you know, always, by the way, tip at events, always know the get to know the photographer because the photographer knows who everyone in the room is.
I
was like, okay, well, I'm in food. Like, I got to meet the food person. So I asked the photographer, who's the food person? Because we were all in this collage, and I could see, like, there's that one dude named Michael who, like, is a food person. Mm-hmm. And she pointed to Michael, and then he was walking, and I was like, Michael, hi. And then so we became friends, and then he introduced me to you.
And he understands that it's and just like you understand, I think, that it's all about the people.
Yeah.
So that's what I was getting to when we brought his name up, is that the only way to run a business that's like that at scale is all about choosing the right people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you can go open a hotel or a restaurant, let's say, in Dubai. Right? And you could have Shake Shack, I think they opened there.
Oh, they have, yes. Right? They're very popular in Dubai.
So Shake Shack is very popular in Dubai.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if the chefs and the cashiers and the people running the stores in that region are not the right people, they're not the people who understand the essence of what Shake Shack is, then in my opinion, Shake Shack will eventually not achieve the same success they have here, there. Now, I mean, there is a slight difference in a market like Dubai or Las Vegas, mm-hmm. where there is a level of impersonal nature.
Yeah.
I think that is changing in Dubai, actually. And in Vegas. But it is. There is like a pushback to that. You know, there's a downtown Vegas development by... Right.
By Zappos, yeah. Founder. What's his name?
I have no idea.
Okay. That dude. Tony Hsieh. Tony? Yes. Yeah.
And Dubai is actually making big investments in food trucks and food culture, which is kind of bizarre.
Interesting. Yes.
Yeah, they want locally
bizarre
sourced
bizarre. Ha, ha.
Stuff. Okay. But in general, if you get the right people who believe, the people who believe will bring to life that vision, because you can't be there. You're going to be back in New York.
And you wouldn't want to be there because Alan just had a new son.
Yes, I did.
Newborn.
River Phillips.
What's his name?
River.
River.
Yes.
That's very hippie of you.
He's a man. I mean, you know, it's funny there, you know, I think it's an up and coming name.
Really?
Okay.
So I'm not in the know about baby names, obviously.
Listen. There'll be a lot of rivers after this river, I'm sure, but...
But will it be the new Michael, though?
No. I hope not.
I hope not, too.
Yeah, but he's amazing. He's so amazing.
Congratulations.
Yeah, he's so amazing. So I'm going to give a shout-out to River.
River! So one day, he's like 5 years old and can understand everything we're talking about...
Yeah.
He's going to be ahead of the game.
Oh, he's going to be a magician.
He's going to be a magician. Then that's so cool that he can... my dad, where's my radio show dedicated to me? All right.
Yeah.
So you had a very unusual path to being you right now. And it's, you know, we can't talk about the immediate next thing that Alan is working on, but we can talk about some of the trends that are relevant. But I want to start from the beginning for a second because, you know, you worked at Myriad and you worked at Strategic in college, right?
Yeah.
While at Cornell.
Yeah, before college, I actually went
before
to be a chef.
Before college, okay.
I actually went out when I was 16 years old and worked in the kitchen at the original Spago.
Very
on
cool.
Sunset.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky enough to get Wolfgang to write me a little recommendation to school. Got into Cornell. Ended up meeting these guys, Noah Tepberg and Jason Strauss, who are behind Strategic Group, which mm-hmm. is Lavo and Marquis and Tao. And they were young guys with a small little office in the Flatiron District who were just really, you know, building their business. And I got to see that change from, you know, a little business to... You know, this, I think Tao is the highest grossing restaurant in the country.
Wow.
In Las Vegas. And those guys have gone on to, you know, tremendous careers of their own. And when I graduated college, they offered me a job. But I thought for some reason it made a lot of sense for me to say, you have to hire my business partner also.
Because you're a loyal guy.
I'm a loyal guy, but it probably was the right thing to do karmically. But, you know, passed up a great opportunity. But anyway, that ended up with me starting my own business. And I started a consulting business.
With your business partner?
With my business partner. His name is Josh. And Josh and I started a company called Sky Group. And
So it's a hospitality consulting firm.
Yeah, it was hospitality consulting. Our first big client was Borgata in Atlantic City. And we did a bunch of... We launched an expansion project for them, which was pretty exciting at that age. I was 24. And this was like a $300 million expansion project. So
it is like the profitable casino in...
It's the only profitable casino in Atlantic City, really. It's been it was a huge, huge, monstrous success.
So how did you go from like college and then suddenly becoming like... Usually it's the opposite. You go do your thing and learn everything, and then you go become a consultant.
Yeah. Well, like, first off, you got a little fake it till you make it there.
Yeah. You're like, what the fuck am I doing?
You got a little fake it till you make it, right? The first one, like the first job, the first gig, the first anything is always the hardest one to get. So you have to convince the people that you know what you're doing. But at that point, when I was doing that, nightlife and food and beverage in casinos was sort of really hitting its stride. Mm-hmm. And in Atlantic City, they wanted to get a piece of that at that point. And so I was, you know, very well versed within the New York market. And they looked at that as like, you wouldn't get that expertise from somebody who's 40, right? You'd get that expertise from someone who's 24, 25, who's involved in that business.
Right.
You know, so my expertise, they didn't need someone to operate the clubs or the restaurants. They needed someone to tell them what's hot, what's cool, how to get the celebrities, how to make sure that people from New York would actually want to go there. And, you know, it turned out to be an amazing learning experience for me, gave me tremendous opportunities. And, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of Atlantic City, but I think it's funny, like Steve Wynn. Obviously, he's a very successful casino operator. He started in Atlantic City.
Okay.
A lot of really, really successful people went through Atlantic City. And so, to me, it's like hospitality purgatory.
Mm.
Like, you go to Atlantic City,
uh-huh.
and you have to do your time, like, for whatever sins you did when you were young. And you learn, and then you get out, and you're able to go on to a wonderfully prosperous career. And, you know, I think... And that's what it served for me. It was a great learning process, and you know, you sacrifice to be there, but it is what it is.
I'm going to foreshadow and say that you invented pop-ups before pop-ups were a thing, and now they still are. It's just this amazing way for entrepreneurs, both in food and not in food, to try something out, do the whole lean method, and get the word out there. More and more people are doing interesting things in non-traditional places. And I love your piece on hardware versus software. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, of course. Well, just before going into the hardware software, I want to just tell you about the pop-ups, because it's important in leading into all this.
Oh, really? Okay.
Actually. Mm-hmm. So pop-ups, they're very related. The reason...
I am kind of smushing together a lot of stuff, because I'm like, oh my God, everything... The pop-ups... Your life makes sense.
My life changed when I did pop-ups.
Really?
Yeah. So, pop-ups for me were like... My business was growing, and then 2008 came along, or 2007, whatever it was, and the economy crashed, and I went from having, you know, my best year ever to having no clients.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided at that point, you know, through the encouragement of some people who, you know, who cared for me and who were there and good guides, that I wanted to do something that was really, you know, honest. You know, I was going through, like, my coming-of-age moment, you know, where I needed...
How old were you?
I was probably, like... I must have been 28, 29, something like that at that point. And I had done a lot of really exciting stuff, but a lot of it at that point had to do with, you know, I think the show, like a lot of ego stuff, a lot of stuff that was more for, you know, showing what I could do, or more worried about, you know, doing the right thing that other people would think was the right thing.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I didn't become a chef was because I thought, you know, I needed to make more money than that, or whatever. And so I decided to do a pop-up because I thought I wanted to get back much more into food, which was really, is really the like core of my being. And I wanted to just do it because I thought it was a really cool thing to do. And it was never about making money. It was just, if I could put out the money and make the money back and do it, it would like set things in the direction. It would almost set things right. And when I did that, when I put aside like the greed and the ego and I just did it, that changed my whole life. From the point I did my first pop-up restaurant till today, my life has been like black and white from what it was before.
So, you know, now the whole pop, everyone gets what that means, but what was like the concept of a pop-up back then? Were you just like, I want to throw a dinner party at the Rivington Hotel, or, you know?
No. The first time I did it, I think I saw that they were doing it in London.
Okay.
And the idea was that, you know, you get together some really passionate, creative people and put together, you know, a once in a lifetime type of dining experience where it was there for a minute and then it was gone. Mm-hmm. It sort of played on that whole idea that people love. They want to be part of an experience that no one else can be a part of, right? And for me, I definitely have a little bit of like idea ADD. Like I have more ideas than I know what to do with. Mm-hmm. And so what could be better than, you know, having an opportunity to take a space over for a period of, let's call it 5 days or 10 days or whatever it was, and put on this, you know, dining experience that would be there and people could be a part of it. And then it was done and then it was over with. And it was just exciting, and it was each time you get to think of a new and different idea. I mean, the first time was just the idea of doing a pop-up was new. Then it was
it like actually a new idea? Like, it's hard for me to understand that like a pop-up is a new idea. Like,
at the same time food trucks were sort of happening.
How many years, what year was this?
This was like 2008.
And, got it. Okay. Right. Cause you know, food trucks were just starting to happen like San Francisco.
So what happened was the economy was happening, right?
Right.
It was going. And then it completely collapsed.
Right.
So there was no money to do new restaurants.
Right.
Right. There was no money to do new things. So people were looking for an alternative method for how do they get out there? Creativity always mm-hmm. lives. It always needs to happen. It needs to get out there. It needs an outlet.
Yep.
So when there was less money, it was, you could do a food truck, you could do a pop-up. These were things, ways to get exposure and ways to prove concepts.
Let's talk hardware versus software, because I absolutely love that.
So that's comes from this. So then I went to Morgan's, right?
Yeah.
And I looked at it and I said, you know, your phone, the example hardware versus software goes, your phone, there was a point where it always needed to get skinnier, right? Everyone was like, oh, I got the smaller. Remember like the Motorola StarTech, right?
There's like the evolution of the mobile phone. It goes from like big to tiny to back to bigger is more luxe now.
Exactly. So, but it was always about the hardware. It was always, you know, really the function was to make phone calls, send an email, but it always got skinnier and cooler.
And better and better.
Yeah. And then now, what is it? It doesn't, the iPhone doesn't really change. It just really, it, you know, it has different apps and it has different things you can do on it.
It has a different meaning and culture. It has a different cool factor. It has a different community and tribe.
Yeah.
So then,
but those are all, they're not physical.
Yeah.
Right? So what happened was we've sort of hit a point with technology where that things have gotten to a form function that's, we're not going to change that form function too much.
It's
until
like
we
pretty
like
good, yeah.
Start thinking, and things just happen when we think. So the same thing with hotels or restaurants is like a hotel. You go to a hotel, you stay in a hotel, and you know, it's, the question is, what's important to you? Like to my mom, her, what was important to her at certain points in her life was, you go to Europe, you go to Italy, you stay in a grand hotel, and you have beautiful sheets and acqua di parma, like skincare and all that stuff, right? Now, the millennials, they don't care about that as much. So they want like a cool, clean, simple room, right? You go to like an Ace hotel, right?
Yeah.
Clean, simple, maybe some sort of design aesthetic, really fast internet, and, you know, maybe you can plug in your Apple TV, all this stuff.
Yeah, so lots of power outlets.
We really don't care. We care a lot more about the experience than we care about the stuff.
Yep.
Right? We care about the meaning, not the money.
Which, for all the hate that millennials get, like, isn't that a good thing? I mean,
that's
come
amazing.
On.
I don't hate it. I think it's the future. If you get, you're either going to get on the bus or, you know, fall off the bus.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, that means that what you do in a space, the experience, okay, which is really, you know, in a hotel, you take a space that's a room, that's a catering room, and you turn it into a pop-up restaurant.
So much
that's
empty
programming.
Space that you can repurpose for, like, good stuff.
It's all programming. It's all about the experience you build and the connection you build with that client. And so that's where magic comes from. So And you take something that's nothing, you put an idea, and it becomes something.
And I think that this this way of thinking, hardware versus software, is completely applicable to not just hotels and mobile phones, but everything else.
Yeah, of course.
You know, app marketing, Sweet Life, Sweet Green, like you just want to create this. You want to create stuff around something that is otherwise like a salad or like a tub of butter, you know?
Exactly.
Or like, you know, something like it's, you know, what it's like. Whatever.
It's the same thing. It's like Airbnb. It's all it is a different take. It's a, they don't own anything. Airbnb doesn't own hotels. They've just taken a resource that exists and repackaged it.
Okay. Right? Totally. And I have two last questions for you. We're going to, We've now landed on magic.
Magic.
I believe in magic. I think the reason why you and I get along is because we're all about the magic.
Believers.
We care about people doing what they're meant to do in life.
Yes.
So you have a book coming out next year. Tell us what the premise is and how do I begin to find my magic?
All right.
Yeah. Well, I know that's the like the whole
version,
book, but
the quick version, the quick version is
we could
that
talk for another hour.
I figured out, I would say over the last year or so, I'm a big believer in purpose, and I figured out that my purpose in life is to help others find and figure out what their magic is and manifest that magic. So, i.e., you are a chef and you love Italian food, and all you've ever dreamed about was opening a mozzarella bar. I would be there to guide you and help you to manifest and get to the point where you are able to do that. That's what I love doing, watching people do that, or helping them or giving them a platform to do it on. And so what I get frustrated with in my job, in any of my jobs I've ever had, from owning my own business to being a consultant to working anywhere, is that I, as a marketer, as a strategy development person, as a, you know, thought, as a creator, I am constantly trying to do things that are intangible, right? Programming. I'm trying to take a space and turn it into something that makes money. I did that, you know, at one of the hotels I worked at. I took a rooftop that was basically non-existent, and it turned it into a rooftop bar that made $1.5 million in 3 months, right? It's all based on ideas. And so, to me, magic is something that is, you know, intangible, but people are willing to pay more for, and they have an emotional connection with, right? So why will you pay more for a salad at Sweet Green as opposed to McDonald's? Why? Because, you know, yes, we think they might use some more quality ingredients or whatever, but you're buying into what it's all about. You're buying into the experience. You're buying into something. That's probably not the best example, but You're willing to pay an extra, and you have an emotional connection to it, and it makes you excited, but you can't feel it, you can't touch it, you can't taste it. It's not actually different. It's just different. So I got really frustrated in trying to explain what that was to people. So I thought, I need to write out the rules. I need to explain this to people so there's a guideline. So someone can ask me, well, why are we doing this? Well, here's the book. Here it is.
Okay.
This is why we're doing it, because it's very clearly laid out here. So if magic is something that you're willing to pay a premium for, how do you get it? Well, first and foremost, you can't manifest anyone else's magic. So your magic has to come from within. So if you figure out what your purpose is in this world, what you actually really are meant to do, and you become, let's just call it self-actualized, which is the whole, I think, the life journey, but definitely the life journey of a millennial, is to get self-actualized, figure out what you really love, what means something to you. Then you can begin to manifest that. And once you manifest it, you know, there's certain ways in which, you know, you can get it out there in the world right now. I think it all comes down to content. You're creating content here today. Whatever you're doing, you need to showcase it. People need to see it. They need to understand it. They need to share it, right? That's why we have all these channels, these social media channels, everyone sharing everything, right? Well, you need to be honest in your sharing of your purpose. Once you do that, then you need to follow the rules. The rules
are in your book.
The rules are in the book, and the rules are all about the universal truths. And the universal truths of like, I'll give you an example of one, is like, really don't be a dick, right?
Yeah.
You could have the best idea and really know yourself and bring it to life, but if you try and, you know, if you're a jerk, it's not going to work. even if you do everything else right, if you're a jerk, it's just not going to work. If it's all about money, if it's all about greed and all, it's selfish, it's not going to work. Because your purpose, one of the keys to your purpose has to be higher. It has to be about other people. It has to be about sharing and helping, because that's what the human society is all about. And the funniest part of the whole thing is, after all of this nonsense, and it goes into a lot more detail, what I realized was that all of this technology and all of this communication has just really gotten back to the fact that you just have to be good and honest. If you try to take advantage and manipulate people, then you can't, you won't do well. And if you're not good at what you do, then people aren't going to buy your pizza, right? If you don't make good pizza, people aren't going to buy it. So if you're just honest and good, that's actually magic. Just be good and honest and do what you love. That's it.
I think the whole millennial movement comes down to just being good and honest.
That's
actually
it.
While everything's changing,
it's not
quickly,
so complicated.
It's very simple. Last question for you, answerable in a few words, is what's your other dream job? I know you're already doing all your dream jobs, but like, if you were to just...
What's my other dream job? I think my dream job is to be a great husband and a great father. That's, if I can do that well, then I've definitely lived my purpose. The rest of it is all, just about sharing with other people in the best way, you can, and being a great example for my family and the people I care about.
Cool. So, yeah. So tomorrow you'd be happy just, yes.
I think I'd be happy just continuing to just do and live and just be a part of like what's happening in the world around me. I think that connecting to people.
No travel writer, no pro footballer.
If I could do anything, I would probably try to, cook for people.
Okay, well.
I'd probably be a chef. If I went back to the beginning, being a chef, but even that, I would rather just want to do it on my terms.
Coming full circle. Thank you so much, Alan Phillips.
Thank you.
With just a little bit of time left to wind it down, we'll talk Champagne Made Me Do It with Kyle Riddington of Piora.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Are you going to get pizza afterwards? Welcome back to Word of Mouth on Heritage Radio Network. And today, to wind it down, we're having on Kyle Riddington of Piora Restaurant. Hey, Kyle.
Hey, Lenny, what's up?
So, thanks so much for coming on. Tell me, what is Champagne Made Me Do It?
Well, Champagne Made Me Do It is a few things, but when you first, typically when you first think of champagne, you usually think of it as a celebratory prop or celebratory vehicle that you only enjoy during, holidays, anniversaries, or birthdays. But I kind of wanted to take an angle and display it more on a casual manner as an everyday drinking wine. It's something that people can enjoy and get to know. So Champagne Made Me Do It, I guess you could say, is a crusade or a content series. We're just kind of marketing champagne in a fun, light, arguably tasteful manner. But just trying to have fun with it.
So you're always dressed up all dapper, and your Instagram is very visually appealing. Where can we find you? What are you on Instagram and Twitter so that we can follow along as we kind of dive in real quick here?
Well, we've been doing the Instagram for, it's going to be about a year this September, so still fresh, but we've done two seasons of Champagne Made Me Do It, meaning that, you know, we shoot a segment of photos and content that lasts us about 2.5 months, and then we take a break and reshoot again, et cetera, et cetera. So right now we're almost wrapping up season three, which will probably be coming on later this month.
So we can find you it's on Instagram and Twitter, right? What are the handles?
Yes, the handle is simply at Champagne Made Me Do It.
Champagne Made Me Do It for both Instagram and Twitter.
Indeed.
Okay, so what is your target audience, and what are you hoping to accomplish?
I would say, I don't know if this is politically correct, but maybe the everyday drinker, or the casual drinker that we often find ourselves to be in New York City. I just, you see a lot of people ordering Sauvignon Blanc, Sancerre, Puy Fumé, and I want to get champagne to the point where people can, you know, get excited and order champagne as casually as that, and they can enjoy it and not think about it, or they can geek out and get into it.
As casual as we are in our pocket squares and three-piece suits. Why champagne over other regions or other kinds of sparkling wines?
That's a great question. Champagne, because I, ever since high school, I've been kind of a history buff, kind of a sucker for history, so the history of Champagne is absolutely astonishing, from, you know, it being an epicenter for battlefields in the Middle Ages, to it moving into the French Revolution and the German occupation, and then, you know, the whole, you know, myth versus fact of Dom Perignon moving into the CIVC and to our, like, current status of kind of, like, in vogue grower champagnes. I just find it, you know, very alluring, and it's just fun to learn about and kind of spread that history to other people in the restaurant.
Awesome. And, yeah. Kyle, when will you be visiting Champagne next?
So I actually just booked my trip 2 weeks ago. I'm going to be going on July 1st to the 9th to visit some producers that I've become pretty good friends with, as well as meet a couple of new producers like Suillard, Jack Picard, Eric Rodé, and Emmanuel Brochet. Oh, and Guy Lamartier. There's a roster.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, we'll be visiting you at PR and on the web. It's actually, Champagne Made Me Do It is so funky and weird. Yeah. It's hard to explain, but everyone go to @ChampagneMadeMeDoIt on Twitter and Instagram. And we can also sign up for your email list as well, right?
Indeed.
And where do we go to do that?
You can just either direct message me on Instagram, or you can reach me at kriddington@pioranyc.com.
Awesome. Thank you, Kyle.
Thanks, Letty.
We're live 2 p.m. Lovely to talk to you. We are live 2 p.m. Eastern Wednesdays on Word of Mouth on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Letty. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.